Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Opinions expressed on the First Coast Connect Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. Police arrest local students protesting the war in Gaza, and campus DEI programs come to an official end. Florida's restrictive abortion policies draw a visit from the vice president. Jurors speak out about the sentencing of a cop killer. And record-breaking temperatures forecast next week offer a preview of the new permanent climate to come. To talk about all that and more, I'm joined by columnist and author Nakisha Williams. Welcome, Nakisha.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Renata DiGregorio, reporter at First Coast News. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Will Brown, race, poverty, and inequality reporter at Jacksonville Today. Hi, Will.
Good morning, Ann.
And attorney and former Jacksonville City Council member Randy DeFore. Hi, Randy.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning. So let's start with the news from overnight. Jacksonville police were on the campus of UNF last night. They arrested nearly a dozen student protesters who are protesting Israel's actions in Gaza. Renata, these campus protests have been spreading around the country. They finally reached the First Coast.
Yeah, you know, I know we've seen more than 2,000 arrests, I believe, nationwide. And earlier in the week at UNF, we didn't have too many people out. We were kind of watching to see what might happen. But then last night is when they decided to stay out past the curfew. It was they had to leave at 10 a.m. or 10 p.m. And they ended up staying longer. And that's when the police showed up. There are a lot more police. I think that's how it's been most of the time, at least here at UNF. There have been more law enforcement officers than there have been protesters part of the time. And then they left in peacefully in the police cars. Now today is graduation. So kind of a lot going on at UNF.
These have been peaceful protests, Nakisha. They've mostly been compliant with demands, including some police told them they weren't allowed to have umbrellas. And so they gave up their umbrellas. And anybody that's been on that green on a hot day knows it's a lot to be out there in the sun. But what do we know about what's going to be happening today at graduation at these campuses around the state? UNF, UF, FSU all have graduation ceremonies today.
I think the students will probably try to take some kind of action, possibly, and that could disrupt the graduation ceremonies, which Florida officials have called for them not to do, and could delay, you know, the commencements and the conference of their degrees. So that is definitely a possibility. We won't know until the ceremonies start, so it's stay tuned. But just in general, the fact that these students across the country, but here in Florida specifically, have found the courage to stand up for a group of people that have been condemned to death through genocide, and saying that that is not necessarily anti-Semitic to stand up for people who are being condemned to die and are looking at their government and their universities and calling for them to do something to stop funding the killing of Palestinian people, I think is very courageous and brave, and I applaud them.
Mm-hmm. The president of UNF, Randy, sent out a note kind of pleading with protesters and the community, you know, noting this graduating class was actually deprived 4 years ago, in many cases, of participating in graduation ceremonies because of the pandemic. And, you know, to be fair, the green is kind of on the opposite side of where the arena is on campus in terms of that protest having any direct bearing on what happens. But the arena is a place where students are also going to be and could protest while part of the ceremony.
That's my understanding as well. You know, and I think that, you know, while I respect people that for their First Amendment rights, I mean, these are students that have worked hard for the privilege and the award of graduating. And I don't think, I personally don't think it's right to take that away from them or even negatively impact that.
Yeah, well, it's a platform and, you know, people will take advantage of that. You've seen that increasingly even in the global warming movement where people are taking increasingly kind of unpopular actions to draw attention. The school issued a statement this morning, and it said that they, you know, had warned these people before they were arrested, these students, that they had lay a campus kind of campus curfew. But we haven't seen, Will, much in the way of anti-Semitic protests. It has been mostly signs along the lines of Free Palestine. You haven't seen quite the from the river to the sea chants that people often equate with, you know, a call to erase or annihilate Israel.
Right. And, you know, the chant is something that, frankly, both sides have said, not here, but that's has been used by both pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian folks. But I would say that, you know, the Students for Democratic Society, they're one of the leaders of these protests and demonstrations. You know, they've been demanding freedom for Palestine before October 7th. They have been at rallies, they've been at demonstrations, they've been when there's been accusations of police brutality in Northeast Florida, they have stood alongside folks and they have said, this is not acceptable. There's always been a Free Palestine sign almost every single place I've gone before October 7th. So their actions are consistent. And in a time when so many people's values are dependent on whether something directly impacts them or their finances, they should be applauded for at least being consistent with their values before, during, and after an event like October 7th.
I want to take a call from Janelle in Orange, excuse me, in Ortega. Give us your comments, Janelle. Thank you.
Yes, I was. I found it interesting this week to notice that among the offices closed at UNF was the Office of Interfaith. That seems so ironic at this time when we're having this conflict between, some Jewish people are feeling threatened on campuses and other places. And at the same time, there's a lot of Islamophobia around. I've had experience with that office in just attending some of their events, which I have found very, very helpful. And something that's so much needed. And it's just, I almost wept when I heard that they were closing that office because of the anti-DEI sentiment among our politicians.
Thanks, Janelle. We're actually going to be talking about the closure of the DEI, all of the DEI functions at UNF in just a little bit. I want to take a call from Kate in Pontevedra. Go ahead.
Hello. This is Kate Roy. Hi, everyone. I just want to say I really support all the protesters. I think they're very brave. I know it's going to be scary when they get all the pushback from the police. And I'm on my way down to J1 down at the jail. There's supposed to be, according to Instagram, a group of people gathering there to give their support to the people who were detained last night. And I know it is very hard and scary to speak out in. I appreciate everything that the protesters have done for the people of Palestine. I also want to say, with the anti-Semitic comments, I personally know three people. I'm 26. I personally know three Jewish people my age, and two of them have been openly speaking out for Palestine. So, yes, I don't know what does that mean. I'm just saying I don't know if this is always a conversation about anti-Semitism. What about Islamophobia? You know what I mean? So anyway, thanks you guys for talking about this on the show. I appreciate all the coverage this is getting. And yep, that's my comments. Stand with you, the protesters. And if they feel the need to talk about our graduation, go ahead, because what else is there going on? Graduation is usually a boring ceremony anyway, so let's spice it up, you know?
Thanks, Kate. Appreciate it. Ed from Orange Park. Go ahead, Ed.
Yes, hi. My concern is that we need to make sure we don't enforce our laws depending on what slogan somebody's yelling when they're breaking them. If you're going to allow people to do what this demonstration have done, which is a lot of vandalizing, just illegally camping on grounds, blocking entrances, blocking roads and bridges, for this particular, if you're going to allow for this particular reason, then why should not allow for the other reason? Everybody thinks their cause is important. If those people were protesting pro-life or secure the borders, doing the exact same thing, a lot of people who are supporting them would probably have a different opinion. And I just think everybody should be equally treated. And that was it. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate Charles. I don't believe we've seen any vandalism locally, and I can't really speak to that on other campuses. Here, there have been, I think, in Florida, certainly kind of a changing list of requirements. I know that that is the impression that students at University of Florida have had, Randy, is that there's kind of this evolving rule checklist that officials have presented. I think it's important, though, and you could probably speak to it, that there are some political pressures involved
there's,
here, right?
There's huge political pressures and funding pressures, right?
Well, so detail some of those for us.
Well, let's just look from a global, from a national standpoint. There are presidents that have been asked to be removed because they haven't handled this. And one of them is Colombia president. And so there is significant political pressures for these university presidents. I think if these protests are peaceful, I'm with the caller. Let's make sure that everyone's being treated equally in terms of what they're saying, whether it's pro-life, pro-choice, or any of these other issues. But what I think we're seeing across the country is something along the lines of what happened in Occupy Wall Street. And I think they're trying to stop that. They saw what happened with that protest. There were paid protesters and then they found that some of these protesters in New York have been paid. So I think they're trying to make sure that these are true students that are protesting. I think in UNF it is. They have been students. It needs to be in my opinion, it needs to be a balanced process. Everybody safe.
I know we heard a little bit of this kind of outside agitator language even at UF, although the paper there reported that of the 9 arrested, 7 were students, really now facing expulsion and pretty severe penalty for their participation. I think that the school said they're going to ban them until 2027 from even being on campus. I want to take a call, though, from Biko in Springfield. Go ahead, Biko.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Anna, for putting me on, just kind of speak what I have been observing since I've been out there volunteering as observer. For the most part, the student has just been very peaceful. The other day, there was a ceremony going on, which, the students still held it very peaceful without disturbing what was going on, despite the aggressions from JSO and the local college police. But for the most part, hearing from a caller to say that these students have been waiting for however many years, and we are taken away from this ceremony. No, we have not taken away from this ceremony. For the most part, what I have been seeing has been very peaceful. So, we just come on to where your value at. Will you rather disturb a ceremonial or speak about kids dying? And we have been witnessing what's going on in Palestine for years now. This is not the first time that this kind of situation has been happening. So it's just that the young people are just catching on, and we want to have a voice to speak about the injustice that's going on in Palestine. So, yes, if that means disturbing the college, yeah, sure, why not? We're not causing any harm to the college. And think about it. The green is a public space. Nobody stopped. That place right there is public for students to have access to it. To charge, to arrest the students there, it is kind of a very low blow, and, it looked bad on UNF.
Thank you, Biko. We appreciate your comments. I want to take a call from John. Go ahead, John.
Hi. I just am so... I guess infuriated by some of the comments that some of your panelists have made this morning that I hardly know where to start. But I want to say, first of all, none of this applies to you. Of course, you do a great job, and I have the utmost respect for Randy DeFore, who should have gotten one of those awards for stopping the JEA from being sold. The comment that there's a genocide going on in Gaza is just not true. The genocide was on October the 7th. Imagine if Mexico were shooting rockets daily at Texas and then came across and killed 40,000 Americans, raping and murdering people. What Israel is doing is entirely understandable, And what choice do they have? If you look at the public opinion polls amongst the Palestinians, or what should be called the Arabs who call themselves Palestinians, 75% to 80% of them have no interest whatsoever in a two-state solution. What they want is a one-state solution in which all the Jews have to leave.
John, I want to just ask you, you said 40,000. If I think that's the number of people in Gaza, roughly, that have been killed, not the number of people that were attacked and murdered in Israel.
No, what the number of people attacked who were murdered in Israel, if you do the math, would be the equivalent of people massacring 40,000 people in America.
You mean like per capita?
Proportionally, yeah.
I gotcha. Okay. Thanks, John. I appreciate it. Nikisha, you're maybe wanting to respond to that.
Yes, because he was talking directly to me. So the number of people who were attacked on October 7th at the concerts and everything that happened is about 1,200. We'll round up to 1,500. The response by the Israeli government and the Israeli Defense Force, which is partially funded by the United States government, is unequal and unconscionable. To find out that 40,000 some odd people have been killed since October 7th in response to that attack, which was heinous, I'm not denying that, is a genocide. And the fact that we are continuing to allow it to happen by passing a bill that just passed recently to fund Israel and to fund Ukraine while also banning TikTok is problematic. And so these students are standing up and saying these people don't need to be condemned to death through the military or also be condemned to starvation because aid trucks are not able to get into Gaza to have people find food. And so now they're starving. That is not fair. We call ourselves a democracy. And we say that we stand up for liberation and for freedom. Where is the freedom for the people of Palestine to not live in an apartheid state? The United States government knows all about that because they had 6 million black people living in that same kind of apartheid state during Jim Crow in the United States. So these students are seeing history repeat itself over and over again. And students have always been on the forefront of these peaceful protests when the governments have been wrong, including with the civil rights movement in the United States and the sit-ins, including with the Vietnam War, and now including with Gaza.
Well, it's kind of what Will was saying. You know, he was saying that some of these protests predate, obviously, what happened in October. And in fact, the Gaza protests at Brown started, at Brown University in Rhode Island, started in 2019. They have successfully pressured their administration to divest from, for instance, South Africa in the 80s, from Darfur, maybe 20 years ago. And so these protests can have an impact in terms of how a school administration, you know, invests its funds or invests its, you know, money.
I mean, American history is evidence that protests work because the United States is a country in and of itself because of protests. But I would say that countries have rights to respond. I mean, Israel was attacked, Israel responded. But more than 14,000 children have died. Children are not, we're not in this. Children are not, they're not young children who are in Hamas. They're children. And so some of the things that I have seen, some of the reporting that I have read is that the demonstrators are specifically voicing their disgust on how children are being treated because they're, no child in Gaza was conceived in a time when there were free elections in Gaza. So they had no say in this and are caught in the crossfire.
But they've been caught in the crossfire for decades.
I want to take a call. Shamari in West Jacksonville. Go ahead, Shamari.
And every one of those dead people is on Hamas.
Thanks, Shamari. Appreciate it. So, Renata, I mean, trying to keep this focus less on the events, more on the protest here. So the schools in Florida have been basically told by the state school administrations that they're supporting tough measures. I mean, they've basically been told you can do what you need to do. And we are seeing, you know, certainly at the other schools in Florida, strong responses to relatively peaceful protests. But as I was saying with Randy earlier, I mean, there's a political element. You have the governor championing this tough crackdown at UF on social media. other lawmakers around the state also responding in kind.
Yeah, it seems like we've had this conversation before, kind of deja vu with UNF or just higher education getting caught in the crossfires with politics. But as you were saying, it says in the memo I was reading with the State University System of Florida, their letter to president said take any steps necessary to ensure safety. I was watching the news, though, this morning on the graduation at UNF, and it looked pretty regular. I mean, they had officers around for safety. They had people, it looked like they were checking bags. So nothing crazy out of the ordinary. But that was a couple hours ago, so I'm not sure if anything has changed by then, if there have been any people there just showing up. But also, when we've been talking about what this could change, I'd like to know kind of across the nation how often student protests do change things, because I feel like a lot of times for students we'll describe it as we're kind of shouting at a wall, we're up against this huge university system. But as you said, we do see protests create change all the time. And I know at UNF they want to show support for Palestine, and then they also want the UNF to be more transparent about donations and ties with Israel. And then just across the country, we've seen Biden just kind of keep the law in order and free speech kind of ways that he's talking about it. And then it is an election year, so it'll just be kind of interesting nationwide what we see come out of this.
I just want to read a couple of comments we're getting on social media. John from Facebook says, citizens dying in collateral damage is not genocide, especially when 80% of those citizens support the terrorist activity of Hamas. Adding, stop the anti-Semitic both sides talk. Mark emailed, we don't get to apply free speech to only the speech we agree with. Same with expression. And Mike emailed, in St. Augustine, we are celebrating the 60th anniversary of Dr. King coming to St. Augustine and joining the civil rights movement. He was also considered an outside agitator, along with Reverend Abernathy and Reverend Andrew Young. He and Abernathy were arrested and jailed in the St. John's County Jail. The same trope of outside agitators was used back then to denigrate the movement. Will.
I was going to say that that was an example of students protesting and causing change, because students from Florida's HBCUs were in St. Augustine to help, you know, people like Dr. Haling, people like Dr. King, like Ralph, Reverend Abernathy and others push the federal government, push the state government, and even work to wade into the waters of the Atlantic by St. Augustine. And then also, to use another statewide reference, the Tallahassee bus boycotts of the early, of the mid-1950s really helped desegregate busing in Tallahassee. So those are two Florida examples of students really, if not leading the way, but being lieutenants to help foster some of the change that they wanted to see.
Randy.
Yeah, I would just follow up on, you know, when I think of Dr. King, I think about love and reconciliation. That's not the message that's being done in a lot of these protests. And I think that is the significant difference.
I just want to take a call from Gabriel. I think he knows some of the students who were arrested. Go ahead, Gabriel.
Hello. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
Hello. I just want to say that when they prosecuted Dr. King was not a popular movement at all. Most of the white people hated Dr. King. He was not a popular...
Gabriel, I think we're going to have to just put you on hold there because there's some background noise.
But to what he was saying, like you said, Dr. King, you think when you think of him, you think of love and reconciliation. That, I believe, is because of the whitewashing of his legacy and what he really was talking about. And while he did advocate for nonviolence and peace, he was also met with aggression. And so, and in that aggression, he continued as he was getting on into towards the end of his life, he was shifting stances and talking about free Palestine and divesting from the Vietnam War and becoming not necessarily more militant, but more adamant about the causes that he was supporting. And that was considered outside agitation to the point of his assassination. And so now we have a reckoning with the man he was and the legacy that's been left behind over the years that he's been gone. And I think what these students are doing is an extension of that legacy that we can even see right here in Jacksonville. Axe Handle Saturday was led by students. Those were student movements and student protests.
You mean the victims?
The victims, yes. Sorry. And so when we're talking about these student movements on campuses like UNF or UF down in Gainesville or even across the nation, it's students who are standing up and speaking out and saying these things are not right. And so to see war and to see death, mass death, is not, it's compassionate to have a heart for the people who are actually victims. It is not anti-Semitic to say that they deserve to live and they deserve to have justice and freedom and food.
Right.
This is Dr. King's nonviolent campaign in his letter from a Birmingham jail specifically talked about the last thing was direct action.
All right, we're going to move on. I want to talk a little bit about DEI because that's another big thing that's happening on campus. This week, UNF closed its Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion formally and for good. That includes four centers that were under that umbrella, the LGBTQ Center, the Interfaith Center, as our caller earlier noted, the Women's Center, which includes the Victims Advocacy Center, which has moved to a different office, and the Intercultural Center. It's a big shift, Renata. This is a school that has long been recognized as a champion of diversity. It's even part of their mission statement.
Yeah, I know UNF ranked one of the best LGBTQ-friendly schools in Florida, too. But student organizations can stay, so I think that's important. There won't be a hub for it to happen, but just hearing from the students, like a lot of these people, this is their mission. This is what they're really doing. I mean, we saw people get arrested in peaceful protests last night. So I think it is fair to say that the student organizations will probably try to continue some of the work. It'll just be interesting to see in the future how this could impact UNF in terms of enrollment. Will they see the same type of people if they were the LGBTQ friendly place and now it seems less so to people who might be applying? Will it stay that way? So just kind of the future, how this plays out should be interesting to see.
You know, Randy, it's interesting. I mean, I think 3 years ago, so many schools and businesses were really leaning into diversity and inclusion following all of the George Floyd protests and this kind of national reckoning, it seemed, with racism and, you know, institutional discrimination. But I guess this is really the definition of a backlash.
That's a great question. Going back to UNF, then I'll answer your question.
Okay.
One of the things that came out of UNF is One Jax, and that has been such an amazing organization, has done so much good for our community. So I agree with you. UNF is thought, you know, that is one of the things that they're famous for is their inclusion.
And for people who don't know One Jax, it's an interfaith organization that sort of celebrates coming together.
And if you've not been to one of their events, I strongly suggest it's amazing.
They're going to be on our program Monday talking about their annual awards. So
going back to your question, you know, I think that because there was this movement in corporate America, it didn't really seem to work. Some question whether it was procedure and that there maybe the leadership didn't really embrace it as they should have. It just was for perception purposes and not necessarily done in a manner that really should have been done in, I guess is the best way to put it. And it didn't, for whatever reason, it didn't work. And I think that because of that, then that spilt over into other areas, including public education. Right. And the funding was taken away.
That's right. And Nikisha?
I don't know if it's accurate to say that DEI programs didn't work in the corporate world, or rather that it is in the face of the reckoning that was in 2020 to ask then Black people to lead diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts at their own office while also dealing with the collective grief that we were facing because of the COVID pandemic, as well as the continued assassinations and killings and lynchings of Black people that we were seeing on autoplay on our timelines from Ahmaud Arbery to George Floyd to Breonna Taylor and so many more. If that is really an accurate reflection to say that, well, it didn't work in corporate America, so now it doesn't work at the university level, to ask Black people to have to advocate for their own humanity while also dealing with grief is unfair in a corporate space.
Yeah, and I think, to be fair, what Randy's saying is that some of those changes were performative, not necessarily
yes,
that they didn't work.
They were absolutely performative. Every day is a good day to hate Black people in America. That's just what it is. And so once it's no longer in vogue or advantageous on the outside in the veneer to look like that you're for diversity and equity and inclusion, then of course take the funding away and dismantle the programs, because who's really going to stand up and say, well, no, I don't want Black people in my office. No, I don't want Black people on my campus. Nobody's going to say that. But by dismantling and defunding these programs, and then even across the entire education landscape, from the book bans to the charter schools, you are actively saying you don't want to share space with people who are different. And that is a problem.
I want to take a call from Wells on the South Side. Go ahead, Wells.
Good morning, everybody. This is Wells Todd calling with Take 'em Down Jax. I just want to make a brief comment, an observation about DEI. Basically, racism must be protected in America. Malcolm X once said, there can be no capitalism without racism. And racism is the big divide. And nobody wants to really get into the economic structure that created it and still exists to this day. And so if we could deal with that and bring people together, then we could face the real issue, which is the economic structure in America. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Wells. I want to move on because there's a lot of other news in the news this week, including a visit this week from the Vice President, Kamala Harris. There were some Gaza protesters at this event, but also mostly focused on abortion. And Will, you were there. So how was the Vice President received? And who else was there in attendance?
The Vice President inside the Prime Osborne was received extraordinarily well. There were elected officials. Obviously, Mayor Deegan was one of the speakers. I saw property appraiser Joyce Morgan in all pink and green and a brooch, obviously. but I also saw a number of Democratic elected officials inside. But there were also activists and lay people, very well received. They were energized, not just by the vice president, but by the Edward Waters Triple Threat band who performed. The belief was inside from the people, women I spoke with, was that their rights were being taken away. That was what they were saying to me, and that Amendment 4, which is on the ballot this November, is a way to potentially earn their rights or win their rights back.
Clear.
That is what they were saying.
I mean, she came
inside
to town on the day that Florida's new 6-week abortion ban takes effect. Is this a key location, Randy, for the vice president? I mean, she's been here once before.
I think, no. You're asking me, you know, as everyone knows, I'm a Republican. I think so, because Donna won. I think that they think they have, I think the Democrat, this is my assumption, that the Democratic Party thinks that they have a foothold in Jacksonville because of Donna winning the mayoral race.
Mm-hmm. But abortion obviously is going to be a big issue this election year.
No doubt. I was reading over the legislation last night. It's a concern. It's if I could speak on a legal basis, it's a concern in my mind for two reasons. Number one, there's an argument that gives the unborn child more rights than the mother. And number two, there's a concern that with the possibility of criminal prosecution, that women will not receive the medical care that they need because of that. And so, you know, I'm very concerned about this law. And because I think it, as a mother, I have a daughter, I think it will negatively impact women's health care in the state.
Yeah. I mean, there are some exceptions, Renata, in this law to the 6-week ban. One of those is an exception in cases of rape or incest, but the subset to that is that the victim has to show proof. So there would have to be a formal report made, even, you know, in the case of incest, which is sometimes very difficult for people to bring themselves to do.
Yeah, there's a number. I know I was reading through the law as well. You have to have a copy of a restraining order, a police report, medical record, or a court order. And so for all of those things, first, the victim or survivor has to come forward and actually file the police report. And we know that goes way unreported because it just causes such a hassle for people to bring all of that up. I just covered a trial, and I thought, you know, this has been going on so long. This has been so traumatizing for so many people. Like, no wonder other people who go through these traumatizing experiences aren't going to go forward and report it. So it does cause that extra part there, and that's been brought up a lot when I've been doing interviews as well.
Renata, I want to play a clip from the vice president's speech, and then let's talk about the angle that she's taking.
This is a fight for freedom. This is a fight for freedom. The fundamental freedom to make decisions about one's own body and not have their government tell them what they're supposed to do. Starting this morning, women in Florida became subject to an abortion ban so extreme it applies before many women even know they are pregnant, which, by the way, tells us The extremists who wrote this ban either don't know how a woman's body works, or they simply don't care.
Now, the state has issued some emergency orders to try to define particularly what it means to pose a risk, a serious risk to a patient's health. But Will, the language of these rules was really political. I just want to read a segment of it. This is the State Healthcare Agency, Agency for Healthcare Administration, and they wrote, "The agency finds there is an immediate danger to the health, safety, and welfare of pregnant women and babies due to a deeply dishonest scare campaign and disinformation being perpetuated by the media, the Biden administration, and advocacy groups, basically to misrepresent the law." Are people surprised to see politics infiltrating the levels, you know, the government levels of health administration? It's maybe not the first time. There has been some politics involved, obviously, in the whole COVID pandemic.
No, not at all. People are not surprised in the slightest. It's from some of the folks I spoke with prior to the vice president's visit. It was expected. This is a way to conjure and win and earn votes. So the politics of it, and I'm sitting here trying to find it, but earlier this week I did speak with Representative Dean Black, who's the chair of the Duval GOP, and he said that one reason...
And a lawmaker,
yes, who voted for the bill that was signed by Governor DeSantis in April of 2023. He specifically said that, you know, yes, there is always going to be... He said that there's always going to be an argument that women may not know that they're pregnant, whether it's at 6 weeks, 15 weeks, or even up until they give birth. That is what Black said to me. And then he also mentioned that one reason why the bill said 6 weeks was because that's when heartbeats are detected and their goal is to protect life. That's what Black says. So people can deal with that information what they will.
And I think from a medical standpoint, there's kind of some electric activity that's happening as opposed to a discernible actual heartbeat. But I think that that's the way that the bill is defined by people who support it.
Correct.
We have a call from Linda in Mandarin. Go ahead, Linda.
Yes. Once again, I just wanted to bring to the forefront is we're getting technical electromagnetic activity, which I don't think I sent the legislators to legislate to be a doctor unless they have an MD degree, including. This is about power. DEI, women's rights, it's about a certain select people deciding for the rest of us in free Florida what freedom is.
All right.
And that is going to determine what side, and people just need to decide, do they want to be really free or fake free, and vote accordingly. Thanks.
Thanks, Linda. I want to move on because it's a good topic, but I also want to get to this issue. Renata, you've been covering this trial for weeks up in Nassau County. It was the case of Patrick McDowell. He was recently sentenced to death by a jury for killing a deputy up there named Joshua Moyers. But you actually spoke to some jurors on this case. I'm really interested to hear kind of how they came to you and what they had to say to you.
Yeah, it was really interesting because I hadn't actually spoken to jurors on such a intense case like this before. And there was a huge twist in this case because Patrick McDowell testified at the beginning. He was the one who confessed to murdering Nassau County Deputy Joshua Moyers. That was in 2021. It was a traffic stop in Callahan in the middle of the night. And he went up before the end of the trial. We thought it was the last day. Like evidence was closed, they're about to do closing arguments, and then there's kind of some unrest, we don't know what's going on, and then Patrick McDowell goes up there and asks the jury to give him the death penalty. And so I asked the jurors I spoke with, what was going through your minds then? And they said that they gave a lot of weight to that, but they didn't actually use it when they were determining whether he should receive the death penalty or he should get life in prison. And the interesting thing, too, is that there are 12 jurors in all of this, 11 of them voted for death, and only one of them thought that there should be a life sentence. I talked with that one juror and then another one who voted for death. And the one who thought he should get a life sentence thought that, well, she was religious, and then also she felt that his military experience, they heard a lot from so many people. I think the defense brought in more than 40 witnesses who talked about his time as a Marine. They called him a perfect Marine, and then he came back and he got addicted to drugs. So he was struggling with meth. He was on meth during the time of the murder, and so she felt that he just did not deserve to die. And she has been, she described it as traumatizing. She said she's been having dreams about it and thinking about it every day. And you could just tell talking with her, the way that she was speaking, that she was like pretty broken up about the case.
It's a case that happened right at a juncture, Randy, when laws were changing on jury unanimity. And so he actually pleaded guilty in this case. He did have to go still through this penalty phase to decide life or death. But he'd argued that because, or his attorneys had argued, because the crime committed, it was committed prior to the law change, and his plea, his guilty plea came before the law changed, that he should be sentenced under the old death penalty law, which required a unanimous jury. And the judge denied it.
The judge did deny it. Well, that's that, I think that was a very good argument on their part. I mean, as you know, it used to be, in order to get the death penalty, the jury had to unanimously vote for death. In this case, it wasn't a unanimous vote. It'll be interesting to see where ultimately what the judge decides, whether he agrees to the death penalty.
Yeah, I've not seen any judge overrule a jury on death before. I mean, especially in a small town, cop killing it, that would be a tough political move.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen it in Nassau County. I think it has happened in other counties, but
yeah,
I think you're right about Nassau.
But it would have been life or death, Will, in this case. That's the difference, right? There's one juror. If it had been under the old rules, he would have gotten a life sentence.
He would have had a life sentence. And it's the thing I can't help but think about is this law was changed as a power move. You know, if someone, it's.
Well, it was changed, Nikisha, in direct response to the Parkland killing, right? So Nicholas Cruz was not acquitted. He was given a life sentence, but that the legislature and the governor basically immediately said, we're changing the law to make sure this never happens again.
But in doing that, life should not be something that should be toyed with, whether it's the end of life or the beginning of life, as we were just talking about with Kamala Harris here for abortion. And so it is a power move. And as one caller talked about, you know, trying to advocate for one issue and not another, the killing in Parkland on Valentine's Day, what was that, 2018, I think. Around there, like, you know, was horrific. Just as a person who admits to killing a police officer is also horrific. But when we have laws and we are talking about someone's life, I personally think there should be a unanimous decision, because that's not a decision that people should take, that should be handed out lightly. Right. And so that if there is one person on a jury who says, you know, maybe life in prison is better, then I think that should be taken into account versus it just being like, well, we'll just go with the majority. But like, rules are changed to benefit political power.
Well, Nikisha Williams, Randy Dufour, Renata DiGregorio, Will Brown, thank you all so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And up next, 123 years later, a local historian recounts how Jacksonville rose from the ashes of the Great Fire.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
On the next Florida Roundup, pay and play. A new baseball stadium in St. Petersburg, renovating the football stadium in Jacksonville. how much public money in Florida should be spent on big major league sports stadiums? What do taxpayers get out of their money for homes for their major league teams? Email us now, radio@thefloridaroundup.org. radio@thefloridaroundup.org. I'm Tom Hudson. Then join us Friday at noon.
Stroke awareness and diabetes management. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. Join me tomorrow at 4 for What's Health Got to Do with It, only on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville.
Crackdown?
This must end now.
Or compromise?
It's working. They're listening. The administration is listening.
Next time on The Roundup, the latest on campus protests and Donald Trump's criminal trial, and what plans does the Biden administration have to weaken weed restrictions?
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Today is the 123rd anniversary of the Great Fire of 1901, which destroyed and ultimately redefined the city of Jacksonville. Here to discuss is Dr. Wayne Wood, author and historian and expert on all things Jacksonville. Welcome, Dr. Wood.
Thank you, Anne. What a pleasure to be here.
It's so nice to have you. So this is a big anniversary of a really big event in Jacksonville's history. Remind us what the Great Fire was.
On May the 3rd, 1901, Jacksonville burned to a crisp. Well, actually not all of Jacksonville. The downtown area and much of La Villa was destroyed in one afternoon. 12 blocks of downtown somehow miraculously survived the fire, but the majority of downtown, where most people lived, where most of the businesses were, the churches, were all destroyed. A swath 2 miles long and 1 mile wide was burned up. The fire began over in La Villa, and if you know where the Ritz Theater is, it was across the street from where the Ritz Theater is today, in the Cleveland Fiber Factory. Uh-huh. Now, the Cleveland Fiber Factory was a very cool thing in itself. It was a block long, and it was where they made mattresses. Workers went out and gathered Spanish moss, and they brought it back to the mattress factory.
Oh, wow.
And ginned it with a cotton gin, and made this fiber called mohair that was the premium quality material for stuffing mattresses with. Well, all this dry fiber was sitting there on a very hot May day, and a warehouse next to it was filled with palm fronds, horsehair, palmetto fronds, all these burnable materials, and an errant cinder caught the factory on fire, and it just exploded up into the sky, casting millions of sparks that landed on the little buildings around it in La Villa with wooden roofs, just as the fire picked up, the wind picked up to 15 miles an hour, blowing toward the heart of downtown. In one afternoon, fire raged across Jacksonville from west to east, stopping at Hogan's Creek and almost spread into Springfield, but that was stopped. And then on the south, of course, was stopped by the river, but everything in its path was burned.
How many people were injured?
The amazing thing about this fire, which was the third largest city fire in the history of the United States at that time, was that only 7 people died. At least that's all that got credited for dying. Perhaps many others died and nobody knew it, but that's the official record. 7 people died. Over 2,000 buildings were destroyed. Over $15 million in damage was done, and that's when $15 million was a hunk of change.
I'm sitting here looking at a book that you wrote with Bill Foley, The Great Fire of 1901, and there are some extraordinary pictures of what was lost, buildings, grand hotels. Remind us a little bit about what the city looked like before the fire.
Well, going back to after the Civil War, Northerners started coming to Jacksonville by the 1870s, and large hotels got built. And Jacksonville was the largest city in Florida at that time, and being close to the ocean with the connection to the St. Johns River, steamships started bringing tourists to Jacksonville. And so in the 1870s and 80s, Jacksonville was the tourist mecca for the East Coast. And with that came grand hotels. And although much of Jacksonville was very bucolic and there were cows and pigs roaming down some of the streets, there were still some very grand buildings. And consequently, Jacksonville was quite well known in the Northeast, in Pittsburgh and New York and D.C. and Baltimore, where the tourists came from. So when Jacksonville caught on fire that May Day, it made headlines all across the country.
Wow. So each year, this is something that we discuss. Is it, I mean, it opened up a whole new era of Jacksonville. So it's not just a piece of history. It really reshaped the entire landscape, the architectural look of the city.
If you look at the pictures of Jacksonville that were taken after the fire, it was like a desert landscape, almost like Hiroshima when the bomb was dropped. And because it was a canvas that was wiped clean, architects and builders and entrepreneurs came from all over the United States to get a piece of the action of rebuilding Jacksonville. Great architects like Henry John Clutho came to the city to rebuild this devastated town. And over the first year after the fire, hundreds of buildings were rebuilt. And by 2 years after the fire, more buildings had been built in downtown Jacksonville than existed before the fire. Mm. And by 1910, Jacksonville had rebuilt its skyline, and it was a glistening city on the river, one of the most modern cities in the country because it had all new buildings, all new technology. The old wooden city of the past was now this gleaming city with skyscrapers across the skyline.
Some of it seems almost impossible that a whole city could burn, but of course, then we saw it happen in Hawaii recently, and you know, you're reminded that that's necessarily not a thing of the past.
Well, prior to Jacksonville's fire, Chicago had the largest city fire in the history of the United States. I believe it was 1873 when a large part of Chicago was wiped out. And then sometime later, San Francisco had the great earthquake. Jacksonville was the third largest city fire at that point in the United States. The flames could be seen in Savannah, Georgia, glowing in the sky. Smoke could be seen in North Carolina. Of course, outlying neighborhoods like Springfield and Riverside that were away from the downtown, they survived. They were not burned, but they were sparsely populated because most of the residents in Jacksonville did live in downtown at that point.
Well, Dr. Wayne Wood, thank you so much for being here and reminding us of the history of the Great Fire.
Thank you, Ann. It's a pleasure to be here to celebrate this ignominious day. We can't say we celebrate it, but we commemorate it because it was a tragedy of gargantuan proportions.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. And that's our program. Join us Monday when we talk about bird flu in cow's milk. And make a plan to join us Tuesday when we take a deep dive into the scandal that involved not just JEA, but FPL, phony ghost candidates, and a statewide effort to undermine elections. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.